It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in for Rob Ferrip. You just heard the song Better by Milwaukee-based band Fever Marlene. There are more Wisconsin bands than ever at this year's South by Southwest Music Festival. And today we're listening to some songs from artists representing Wisconsin.
Indie band Fever Marlene met while studying at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. The band produces all its own material and recently released a full-length album called Medicated Friends. The band has a thing for actress Marlene Dietrich. That's where they got their name. Here's a little bit more of their song, Better.
U.S. Representative Paul Ryan came under fire this week after commenting on the lack of a culture to work in America's inner cities. Appearing on Bill Bennett's Morning in America show on Wednesday, Ryan responded to a question about what Bennett called the fatherless problem. Let's listen to what Representative Ryan had to say.
We have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular, of men networking and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. And so there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with.
That particular comment has garnered a lot of talk and a lot of discussion. And with us today is William Jones, professor of history at UW-Madison, focusing on race, class, and work. And he's here not just to reflect on Representative Ryan's comments, but to also help us understand some of the real barriers to ending inner-city poverty. Will, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, first thing, as I mentioned, there has been quite a reaction to this comment. Representative Barbara Lee from California sees the remarks as what she called a thinly veiled racial attack here in Wisconsin. U.S. Representative Gwen Moore said she agreed with Ryan to the extent that poverty is caused by a culture of inequality, but she says she sees that culture slightly differently from Representative Ryan. When you first heard this, what was your reaction to it? Did you ears perk up the same way theirs did?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind the context in which he was making these statements, and it was in the release of a report that was it was framed as a review of the success of the war on poverty after 50 years, and the conclusion or the tone of that report was repeatedly the assertion that the war on poverty had been a failure, that it had not addressed the problem of poverty or solved the problem of poverty. And so the report was premised on the idea that there needed to be a new way of looking at how to address poverty. And in Ryan's view, that was looking at this, what he identifies as a cultural problem of men not working, of generations out of work, of people who have lost touch with the value and the culture of work. So I think that's the context in which I viewed it, and I think it was the context in which we see that very strong reaction, both on the grounds of him sort of singling out African Americans, which was Boxer's point, saying that the referring to the inner city was a sort of coded way for referring specifically to African Americans, and then also of Representative Moore saying this ignores the real broad structural barriers to people in inner cities getting full-time employment and decent jobs.
In Representative Ryan's defense yesterday, he has since said that his comments were inarticulate and that they weren't about race. And what he was really trying to say is that it's a larger societal problem and that we've allowed society to segregate, isolate the poor into different places like the inner city. Is that something that you agree with?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to take him seriously and to argue on his basic point, which I think we can interpret. We can go back and forth about what he meant by inner city, whether he was sort of using coded words for race. But I think what he was pointing back to was the basic point, which is the premise that the war on poverty was a failure. And the report cites over and over studies that he claims shows that federal anti-poverty programs have not worked. And that that's actually blatantly false. I mean, if we look at the history of the war on poverty, even many of the economists that he cites in that study have come back and said, look, he's been misinterpreting our evidence and our studies. The fact is that poverty rates in the United States declined from 26% in 1967 to 15% in 2012. And we have to remember the context. 1967 was a relatively good time for the American economy. 2012, we were still recovering from the second biggest recession in the 20th century. So to compare those and say that there hasn't been an impact on poverty is simply wrong. And you can only arrive at that conclusion if you really misinterpret the evidence, which he was doing in that report. So I think it is important to actually focus on what he's actually saying and not trying to misinterpret what he's saying. He is saying that these have been a failure.
Well, let's talk about the war on poverty, because it was the 50th anniversary, I think, not so long ago of that effort. And we've heard a lot about it in the last month or two, where people have been talking, you know, this is what the impact was. And it has quickly, very quickly, I think, turned into sort of this political football where the division seemed to be pretty stark. On the one side, you've got folks like Representative Ryan who say it's been a failure. On the other side, other people are saying, wait, not so fast. You know, we need to take another look at this. It has been successful, maybe not in winning the war, but certainly in winning some of the battles. If you could, for a second, tell us how you were citing some figures there. Talk about that so-called war on poverty and what you see as the successes and failures.
Right. Well, I think the biggest successes of the war on poverty actually come in federal funding that was not specifically tied to sort of means-tested programs. It was perhaps the single most successful programs that come out of the war on poverty are actually Medicare and Medicaid, which provided subsidized, often free health care for the poor and the elderly. They had a tremendous impact on poverty rates, particularly in the late 1960s. Another important aspect of the war on poverty that was tremendously successful was increased federal investment for housing, for education, things like health care, again, like Medicare and Medicaid. And these actually had a double impact. On one hand, they alleviated some of the effects of poverty. They actually benefited middle-class Americans much more than poor Americans. But the impact that it had on poverty also came in the fact that they provided jobs for the urban poor. So in the health sector, which is has been the fastest-growing employment sector in the country since the 1960s, in education, in housing. Importantly, another added effect was the unionization of these jobs in the 1970s and 80s. And I think when we look at this, we have to actually also turn back to the fact that these are actually the programs that that Ryan is talking about cutting. He's saying these things don't work. We need to cut these things. And they actually are having a tremendous impact and had a tremendous impact on alleviating the effects of poverty. Have they eliminated poverty? No. We still have poverty. But to take that and to argue that this has been a complete failure, I think, is disingenuous.
And I'm not sure how to articulate this myself, but when he says, you know, we've got generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and culture of work, it seems to me that he's saying that, and I'm not sure what documentation he might be using to back that up. But on the one hand, they're, you know, he's saying they're not thinking about learning the value and culture of work. On the other hand, it seems as though some of those job efforts to bring jobs to those areas, that, whether it's the inner city or wherever poor people might be, those efforts just aren't there to the extent that they may have been.
Right. I mean, I think Representative Moore was absolutely correct to point to this being it is a cultural problem, but it's a cultural problem that we all share. I mean, we are in a shared culture that is not investing in inner cities, is not investing in the transportation and housing programs that would allow people who are the urban poor to move out of these cities. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that this is a problem that affects not just the inner city poor, but also the rural poor. And in that sense, I think we do get a degree to which I think Representative Boxer was correct to point to the racial overtones of this, that when he's talking about inner city being, you know, equating poverty with inner city, we also have rural poverty, and it's largely white. And so when you single that out, I think there is a racial implication. But the way in which I think it's important to point to the structural causes behind these inequalities is something that's missed when we focus on the cultural problem.
We're going to be taking a break right now, and when we return, we'll continue our discussion with William Jones, a professor of history at the UW-Madison. His work is on race, class, and employment. He is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights.
And we want to hear from you on this. What do you see as the primary cause of poverty in inner cities and elsewhere, and what's your reaction to Representative Ryan's comments? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can also comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Hi, I'm Gene Purcell, and this is Central Time. We're talking with William Jones, professor of history at the UW-Madison. His work focuses on race, class, and work, and he is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights.
And you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Are there barriers separating you from a well-paying job? And what do you make of Paul Ryan's recent comments about poverty and a lack of a culture of work in inner cities? You can also tweet us at CentralTimeWPR.
So before the break, we were talking a little bit about the war on poverty and some of what you saw as the successes of it. And as I was listening to that conversation, it struck me that in addition to these particular comments and that Representative Ryan made, there's also been this larger conversation that has been going on for the past couple of years about the whole notion and the whole idea of income inequality in the United States, the fact that the 1% seems to be getting smaller, and there's that middle class seems to be shrinking somewhere. And I'm wondering how that discussion plays into some of these other issues that we're talking about here, or does it?
Well, I think it does, because I think as a nation, we're often reluctant, I think, to think about sort of structural barriers to equality. We think of this as a nation where anybody, if they work hard, they can get ahead. And the fact is that increasingly since the 1960s, that has not been the case. We've seen these rising levels of income inequality. We've seen declining levels of social mobility. So if you look at advanced industrialized countries, the United States ranks the lowest, second only to Great Britain, in terms of if somebody's born poor, are they likely to die poor? There's sort of levels of income mobility. The fact remains that we live in a society where it's actually very difficult for people to change their class status. And that goes against everything that we're taught about in this, that we believe in this country. And I think Ryan is not alone in sort of looking for solutions for this or answers to this.
And so when we hear the idea that what people need to do is have the right attitude and go out and get a job and sort of pull themselves up by the bootstraps, it's not always quite that simple.
Right. And there's actually a very long history of people ascribing poverty, explaining poverty through the behavior of the poor. And it's interesting that there's a pattern of scholars actually studying the behavior of the poor and finding that the poor, you know, poor people don't always do things that are in their best interest. So Oscar Lewis, for example, back in the 50s, did a number of studies, and he found that poor people, you know, sometimes they do things that help to keep them in poverty. But he was very clear to say, this isn't why they're poor. These are behaviors that come from being poor, but it doesn't keep them poor. And it's not the solution to poverty. But he was very quickly interpreted as saying the culture of poverty is what causes poverty. Representative Ryan actually did the same thing with a study by Robert Putnam that he cited at the beginning of the quote that you played. He said he referred to Bob Putnam at Harvard, who has done a study finding that poor children tend to have lack of connections to things like families and churches, other community institutions. Putnam didn't say this was causing them to be poor, but Ryan interprets this as the cause of poverty, not an outgrowth of poverty.
Let's go to the phones right now. We've got some listeners who would like to join in, and Mark starts us off, and Mark is in Cambridge. Hi.
Hi there. I've been listening to what he says, and there's quite a bit of truth to what he says. But what's happened in this country is that we've at times replaced entitlement with enablement. And the other problem is that we've removed the lower rungs to the ladders of opportunity. There's an exodus of industrial opportunities, work industrial opportunities, everywhere in the state, particularly in the inner cities. And the faces of those people, when you drive down through those areas, the faces are faces of people that don't know opportunity because there is none.
Mark, let's leave it right there and get a reaction from our guest, William Jones. Two issues there. The idea that Mark brings up of entitlement versus enablement, that is one that you hear an awful lot about, you know. And in your mind, how do you differentiate those? And what are we actually looking at these days? I mean, are we entitling or are we enabling? Or is it a lot more difficult to define than that?
Often when the word entitlement is used, it's sort of the concept that people feel they have, they're entitled to certain benefits from society. I think we do live to a certain extent in a society that associates certain benefits with citizenship. People expect to have access to education, to decent education. Paul Ryan himself is somebody who has benefited from the Social Security program that is designed to entitle people with a certain cushion in hard times. And I think many of us expect those things to be there when we fall on hard times. I think the caller really points to an important issue of, you know, is the problem that people aren't looking for opportunities, or do they not have access to those opportunities? If we look at Milwaukee, for example, Milwaukee is a city that African Americans moved into in large numbers because there were these manufacturing jobs. In the 1970s, Milwaukee had very low levels of unemployment. The black communities in particular were disproportionately wealthy and prosperous if you compare Milwaukee to other cities in the country. But those jobs disappeared, and they moved to the suburbs, and they moved overseas. And the question is whether people have the ability to find the jobs that have moved. Do people have the ability to move out of the inner city or travel out of the inner city for work? And I think those are the barriers that we need to be looking at.
Let's go to Ed right now, and Ed joins us from Four Corners. Hi, Ed.
Yes, hello. I was born and raised in Milwaukee, and my mother and my brother, they have 50 years of continuous teaching in the Milwaukee public school system. And I do sympathize, understand where the caller is coming from. I remember growing up as a kid in the 70s, and the inner city seemed to be much more vital than it is today, and American Motors Corporation plant and those jobs just don't seem to be there. But my question is, to Paul Ryan's point, since 1965 and the establishment of the Department of Education and then the forced integration of the school system in the early 70s, we now have an urban school system which is predominantly minority. And I'm just asking the question, in terms of test scores and graduation rates for minority students, have we seen improvements? And how does he explain the racially segregated schools despite our efforts at integration?
All right. William Jones, what role does education play in this? Because that's something we hear an awful lot about, and certainly schools in Milwaukee, public schools anyway, are mightily challenged to have significant graduation rates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really critical part of this puzzle, and I think one of the factors that we should consider is the way in which education and school funding and school attendance is determined by residential patterns. The Milwaukee metropolitan area is the most racially segregated metropolitan area in the country. And that's why we have a concentration of African Americans in inner city schools that are dependent on a tax base that's declining.
We've only got about 30 seconds or so left here, but I want to ask, you know, this so quickly seems to turn into an ideological debate, mm-hmm. at least when it gets into the political sphere. Are we going to be able to get beyond that anytime soon?
Well, I think, you know, I think the one benefit or one bright side that we can take from all of this is that we have a conversation about poverty, which we really haven't had a serious conversation about poverty in decades. And I credit Paul Ryan with bringing us back to that conversation, and I hope it continues. And I think it's important to take the evidence seriously and really look carefully at these issues.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. William Jones is a professor of history at the UW-Madison. His work is on race, class, and employment. He is the author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This year, Wisconsin has its largest presence ever of musicians at Austin's South by Southwest Music Festival. And throughout the show today, we're going to be playing songs by those bands. What you just heard is Blame Me by Hugh Bob and The Hustle. Lead singer Hugh Masterson grew up in Butternut, Wisconsin, up north, a little town with a population of about 300. Hugh Bob and The Hustle play what's known as North Country Rock and Roll. Let's listen. And we've got more Wisconsin music coming your way in the program. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday, and the date is 314, which only means one thing. We're going to be talking about pie. A pie enthusiast from WPR will be joining us to share recipes and talk about his favorite pies of all time.
First, though, we're tracking Wisconsin's musical talent and heading down to Austin, Texas for South by Southwest to check in on how Wisconsin bands have been performing this year. With our largest presence ever at the festival, Wisconsin will be putting on performances of all sizes. Better known bands like Fox and Hugh Bob and The Hustle are playing official shows. And in addition, over 30 Wisconsin acts were featured at the Milwaukee Home Stage this past Wednesday.
Joining us now from Austin to update us on those performances is Milwaukee Journal Sentinel music writer Piet Levy.
Piet, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So we're playing songs from Wisconsin bands at South by Southwest throughout the show today. We started with Blame Me by Hugh Bob and The Hustle. What do we know about these guys?
Yeah, well, they're based in Milwaukee. The main guy, Hugh Robert Masterson, he's from Butternut, which is a really tiny community. But he lives in Milwaukee now, and they're, you know, kind of a bar room country rock band. They have started to get some attention from CMT. CMT is going to be premiering their music video, I think, in a couple of weeks. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I'm the music writer from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We had a feature, 10 Wisconsin Bands to Watch, and Hugh Bob and The Hustle is definitely a very promising band that should get some bigger attention, I predict, beyond the Milwaukee area. Just because they have a really good sound, they're really dedicated performers. They are getting some attraction from people in Nashville. They had a song that had a placement on Nashville. So they're very good. And if you're at South by Southwest, hustling, you know, no pun intended, I guess, playing shows, networking with people. And that's what bands come out here to do, that and party.
Of course, we can't forget the party part. Well, their sound is something, it's called North Country. What does that mean? Is that something, loneliness, empty bars, desolate highways? Is that the North Country sound?
I think maybe so. I mean, I think they kind of describe themselves as like Midwest country a little bit too. And that's kind of their description for it. I mean, it's definitely, it's not like necessarily straight up twangy country. It's definitely not country pop. It feels like kind of like, you know, it's almost like indie rock gone country in a lot of ways. And I think that's also helped them too, because country is just a growing, booming market. We're starting to hear more diversity in country. Last year there was a lot of complaints about the bro country movement and how radio was very, didn't have a lot of openness, open-mindedness. But then last year we also saw artists like Casey Musgraves, Brandi Clark, come in with a kind of an alternative sound. And I think as country continues to grow, as country's audience continues to get younger, I think that, that puts you, Bob, and Hustle in a really great position.
Well, you've been down at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas for a few days now. Can you set the scene for us? Describe it. What is it like?
It is insane. I think that's a mild way to put it. It's my second year here, and it's nothing. Basically, it's a massive festival that's been going on for a few decades now. It's really grown to a beast. The whole kind of myth behind South by Southwest, or the brand idea, is that you come here to discover new music, and that's still definitely possible. But, you know, as it's attracted tons of artists hoping to get discovered or to make great connections, it's also attracted massive artists and brands. Lady Gaga played the Doritos Bowl stage on Thursday night. Had Kanye West and Jay-Z do a show for Samsung for attendance. Coldplay did a show for iTunes. So it's a really huge thing. But at the same time, you also have thousands of bands playing official Southwest showcases, little-known bands, and also a lot of bands playing, maybe just as much, playing unofficial shows, just here to just see if they can bump into somebody, here to just play music, here to kind of feel what the vibe is like. It's really crazy. People are having a lot of fun. I think people can get pretty stressed. I've seen a few agitated bands, you know, around town. But it's an interesting, nutty, crazy experience. And we had a lot of Wisconsin bands this year, way more than we've had in recent years.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. South by Southwest is an event that can make stars. It's a big opportunity. Are there any Wisconsin bands that you think have the opportunity to really break out this year?
Well, I mean, I'll say that South by Southwest, I think there is that idea that it can make stars, but I would still hesitate on that a little bit because I think a lot of the bands that kind of break out of South by Southwest are kind of known going in, or there's a buzz kind of going into it. So, you know, and it's so, that's, at this point, it's so crowded, it's so huge, there's so many things happening. It's I think the idea of a band comes here, they get seen by some, you know, record exec drinking a Shiner Bock, and they're like, oh, I'm going to sign those guys right now. That's kind of a myth. But the great things can still happen. I mean, last year there's a band called Fox. They're in Madison. Terrific band, and that might be one of the most promising indie rock bands of Wisconsin right now. They just got signed to Partisan Records. They played South by last year. It's their first show, I think, out of Wisconsin. And they kind of came, you know, there was some buzz around them already. They had a video EP that was really ambitious that was gaining some traction. They came, played some shows, had low expectations. They did happen to play in front of a manager who offered her services, and she's a well-connected manager. She manages the Lumineers, and she got Fox to play at Lollapalooza in Chicago last year. She helped Fox open for the Lumineers at the iTunes Festival in London. She got them on tour, or she helped get them connected to get on tour with Blitz and Trapper. They're now signed to Partisan. So things like that can happen. So as far as this year goes, so with Wisconsin bands breaking out, I mean, we'll just have to see. I don't expect any Wisconsin bands are going to suddenly become superstars or get record deals necessarily right away. But hopefully they do meet some people that can kind of help them in some small way. And as far as bands that might stand a better chance of doing that, well, Vic and Gab is a band from Milwaukee. It's like a pop rock band that they're doing some official showcases and have gotten some national media attention. U-Bob and Hustle doing official showcases as well. And then on a small level, a really small level, there's a band called Paper Holland from Milwaukee. It's a band I really like. They're kind of a pop-rock band. They have a little bit of a Death Cab for Cutie vibe to them, sometimes a little more upbeat energy. And, you know, their song was just kind of discovered randomly by Stephen Thompson at NPR, and he included it in a 100-song ecstasy playlist. So, you know, again, I don't think Paper Holland is going to get a million calls from people, but they were just so ecstatic to get some national attention like that. So you just have to kind of come in with measured expectation.
I understand the Milwaukee home stage was on Wednesday. What was that like? How did it go?
Yeah, what was interesting, and the reason I think there are so many Wisconsin acts here this year, is because a few folks got together and kind of had this idea to do a Milwaukee showcase. The folks that organized it include one of the owners of Hotel Foster. It's a small venue in Milwaukee, and also Melissa Thornton. She founded an apparel company called Milwaukee Home in Milwaukee. And they kind of came up with this idea, and they thought they would do it for 2015. There's a lot of that around South by Southwest. You'll see showcases for Portland bands or Colorado bands or bands from England. And they wanted to do something for Milwaukee. But they had this idea around Christmas. In January, they founded a club that was like right smack between the Austin Convention Center and 6th Street was available. And they decided to go ahead and jump at the opportunity. So they tried to put together a showcase for Milwaukee bands in like 2 months' time. And they wanted to go really ambitious, so they got 30 bands to sign up for it. And they went to raise money, and they raised about $24,000. It was pretty crazy. I mean, I think for anyone who has experience, that would be a really, really hard thing to kind of pull off. So it happened. It definitely had hiccups. There are definitely things to learn. Ultimately, I think the showcase they basically played for themselves and played for friends more so than attracting people from, you know, booking agents and things like that. But it was a start, and I think a lot of bands, you know, even though there were some hiccups and frustrations, I think a lot of bands were excited to have the opportunity, excited to be here, excited to see other bands. Some of these bands have been meeting up with other bands just randomly. So, you know, there's still benefits, too.
So looking back, you know, we've had Justin Vernon come out of Wisconsin. You've got Fox up and coming out of Wisconsin. Does Wisconsin have a reputation for being an up-and-coming state that's a good place for music?
I think it's definitely recognized. I think Justin Vernon, for sure, helps. And, you know, Vernon has this band, Volcano Choir, that he's in with current and former members of an avant-garde group in Milwaukee called Collections of Colonies of Bees. They're a group that has some cult recognition, but when they teamed up with Vernon, just because of Vernon's name, suddenly these guys were able to play bigger venues than they've ever played before and tour places they've never been before and have, like, snacks on a touring bus. So I think by having someone that has, like, a name like that, it definitely helps. It kind of creates a wave effect.
All right, Piet, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for giving us the sights and sounds of South by Southwest.
Thanks a lot. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We've been speaking with Piet Levy, music writer at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He is in Austin, Texas, covering Wisconsin bands at the South by Southwest Festival.
Wisconsin has its biggest presence ever at the festival this year, and throughout the show today, we are playing songs by Wisconsin bands performing down there in Austin.
Coming up, a pie enthusiast from WPR joins us to talk about pies for this Food Friday. But first, Noah Ovshinsky joins us from the newsroom with a look at headlines. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's time for Food Friday. And since today's date is 3-1-4, what better time to talk about pie?
And the first person who came to our minds when we thought pie was, of course, Michael Leland. He's the news director here at Wisconsin Public Radio and a pie lover to the max. He's with us to talk pie. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks to be here.
Well, we're starting with a big question here. What do you love about pie?
What don't I love about pie? And I think you had me on the show because you figured, well, he'll bring a pie in if he's going to be on the show. I have just, you know, it was always a treat, you know, when I was growing up. It's not something, you know, Mom made brownies a lot. She made cookies. But holidays were when the pie came out, whether it was from Mom or from my grandmother. So it was always something kind of special. And as I got older, I always liked to cook, but once I got out on my own, I thought, well, how hard can it be to make a pie? Give me a try. And the rest is sort of history.
So how hard is it to make a pie? As I understand it, I haven't heard the story yet, but I understand your first attempt at making a pie did not go so well.
You know, there's nothing wrong with walking away from something for, I don't know, say 10 years if it doesn't go well the first time. I had a little bit of trouble with the crust. I wanted to make my own crust because I thought if I'm going to make a pie, I'm going to make a pie. Mm-hmm. And the crust was sticking to the rolling pin and not going well, and I was probably saying things that we can't say on the radio. And I decided this is just too much stress, and I just put it away and just never thought about it until about 10 years later. And I thought, I haven't tried making a pie in a long time. Let me just follow the instructions, and how hard can it be? And
it was better this time, I think?
For some reason. To this day, I don't know why, but it just went better. And since then, I probably make several a year now, and that was – you know, we're looking at the last 15 years now. So it's not real difficult. It's more time consuming than anything, and you kind of have to be patient because sometimes it doesn't go quite the way you want it to the first time if you've never made one before. But you know, it's not awful.
Do you remember what the pie was that brought you back from the pie abyss?
It was probably just a basic apple pie. If you know, I tend to make a lot of fruit pies. I make some savory pies, but for the most part, it's fruit or you know, there's one I make around this time of year that's got chocolate and marshmallow and Guinness stout in it. And but you know, but for the most part, there, you know, this stuff you want to have for dessert.
Now, you just mentioned there, often, just such an offhand manner. There's one I kind of make. That pie is legendary, Michael, at WPR.
It's the one, yes, it's the most requested.
It has Guinness?
It has a Guinness stout in it. I'm sure other stouts work, but I usually use Guinness. It's got mini marshmallows and chocolate chips, melted chocolate chips. Those are the three big ingredients. It's also got a few other small things here and there. It's easy to make. You can make it pretty much in your blender and then dump it into a graham cracker crust that you can either make yourself in about 10 minutes or you can buy one. And, I mean, the one I made for today, I think I threw it together in like 20 minutes last night and then put it in the fridge because
wow.
You don't have to cook it. And as you can attest, it's a big hit.
It's a huge hit. And
20 minutes well invested, and look at all the love it's brought just in
That's
one
That's right. People
one
will
day.
Love you.
It'll
you
get you
that.
On the radio, people.
You know, but you mentioned in your horror story from many, many years ago when
yeah.
you started making pies, and just there as an aside, you said you could use your own crust or you could make a crust or whatever. That's also always something people think about because I think it actually stops a lot of people from making pies is that fear of the crust.
Mm-hmm.
So where are you at these days? Homemade or do you buy? And what are the pros and cons?
I mean, because I'm usually able to make a crust without any, you know, great disaster, I always at least try to make a crust. I only buy a crust if I know I just don't have a lot of time and just want to, you know, knock the pie out real quick. But for the most part, I would say 95% of the time I will just, you know, make a crust.
So what's the secret to a good crust?
Boy, you know, I don't even know if there is one. I mean, the one I use is just a real basic recipe. It's just flour, a little bit of salt, about a third of a cup of butter, a third of a cup of Crisco, some water, mix it up, and you know, let it sit in the fridge for a bit and then roll it out. And yeah, I mean, there are other variations. There are some crusts with a lot more butter and vodka in it,
mm-hmm.
Which always makes people go, really, vodka? But you can't taste it because it cooks out.
So what's the point?
It's it makes it flakier. It makes it, I would say it's got a richer taste to it, and it can be flakier than the standard butter Crisco crust. Noah Ovshinsky is always after me to try lard in my pie crust. I haven't gotten there yet, lard, because I don't know where to buy lard. But but one of these days I'll try that. But I just go with what's easy.
Well, my grandmother was a big believer in lard, and
mm-hmm.
it works. So if you can find it.
One of these days, it's on my list.
Give it a shot.
I'm sure there's lard to be had somewhere in Wisconsin.
You'd think.
You'd
think.
Now, we mentioned your chocolate stout silk pie. Now, you use Guinness.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have that recipe up on our Facebook page. And because it has Guinness, I think it's fair to pass that off as a St. Patty's recipe.
Well, this is sort of how this is actually how I found this pie. We were having a St. Patrick's Day party here at WPR. This is only a pie I've been making about for 7 or 8 years. So I went online. I thought, you know, I'm going to make something St. Patrick's Day. And I found this website that had Irish, you know, related recipes. And this was a recipe that had been posted by a brew pub in New Brunswick, Canada. And I thought, well, it's pie, so I can make that. And it's got Guinness in it, so that makes it Irish. So here we are, and that's really where it came from. I don't even know if this place is still in business anymore, but you know, I'm forever in their debt for
their
posting that recipe.
Their pie lives on,
right.
Huh?
Right.
You also make one, I gather, an apple maple cranberry pie. What do you like about that one?
Yeah, I like it because I mean it's all of the things that I really like a lot. You know, I love apples, I love cranberries, I love anything maple. I grew up in Massachusetts; those are all great products from where I came from, and as it turns out, they're great products from here in Wisconsin as well. So it's a little bit of home and a little bit of where I live now when I make it. But I just love all of those tastes together, and it's a pie that I like a lot, and it's also fairly easy. It's actually more time consuming than the chocolate pie. because you've got to cook down the cranberries and that sort of, you know, you've got to peel about, you know, 3 pounds worth of apples. But it turns out well. I like it.
Speaking of taste all together, let's talk about savory pies for a second. You've got a recipe for a pork and apple pie.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a recipe I found in a British cookbook. This is a day-long project. It takes about 4 hours to make. And you've got to make a thick crust that pretty much stands up on its own. You don't even make this in a pan or in a pie plate. You've got to make a crust that you tie string around the outside to support the walls of it.
I was going to make a joke about bracing, but it sounds like it's no joke.
You really do. You have to brace this thing. It's got ground pork and bacon and cubed cut up pork in it. So wow. Three different kinds of pork and apples, some sage and a few other things. I can't remember what, but you cook it for about 2.5 hours. It's fantastic, but it's a project.
It's a project, and what, I mean, what else would you have with that? I mean, it sounds like a meal in itself.
It's pretty much a meal in itself. I might steam some broccoli just to convince myself that maybe it's a bit of a health food.
I can't believe the three kinds of pork in that pie.
I call it the three pigger.
For more than one reason. Yeah. Right. That sounds like a big one. So what advice do you have for the pie novice, someone who's intimidated, maybe like you used to be, by the idea of making pies, but they want to try?
If you just want to make a pie, buy the crust and concentrate on the fillings, and then maybe someday try a crust or buy a crust and have it in reserve in case the crust you try to make doesn't turn out the way you like. At least you haven't lost the pie completely. But give it a try. I mean, it's not a difficult thing, and don't worry about how it looks. That's the other thing, that if my crust tears, I will just patch it with another piece of dough that I'm not using, and it's all about the taste. It's not about the presentation, at least in my world.
Well, Michael, thanks for being here today.
Happy to be here. Thanks a lot.
That was Michael Leland, news director and pie master here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
And don't forget, the recipe for that Guinness marshmallow pie with chocolate is up on the Central Time Facebook page in time for St. Patrick's Day.